Ladies and gentlemen, this is a very roomy crowd. Good afternoon. My name is Ken Cribb, and it's my pleasant assignment to preside at this luncheon session. Some of our guests have correctly deduced from my accent that I was president of the society when both the topic and the site of this meeting was decided. So we find ourselves in Charleston, where it is said that the Ashley and the Cooper Rivers meet to form the Atlantic Ocean. I was born in the upcountry, but most of my mother's family was born and still live within a few miles of this hotel in Dorchester County. And I will say further to the presentation this morning from Professor Robach that my mother's family would be characterized as successful secessionists. Having formed Dorchester County in the late 19th century from portions of Charleston and two other counties, and since then, in the 100 years that have ensued, it has mattered very little to the voters of that county who is president of the United States, or what parties those presidents belong to. What has mattered was the electoral fortunes of the two political factions in the county, the OBLs and the DRLs. Now, my family belonged to the OBL faction, and it has now been forgotten what OBL stood for, except that my grandmother thinks it may stand for the initials of Old Boss Limehouse. It is all too clear, however, what the initials DRL stand for. Dorchester Riddensleigh formed to get rid of my family. An effort that has been only episodically successful. Now, when I was a young man, I would visit Dorchester County to try to get to the bottom of these fascinating local politics, but the wizened elders of the county turned aside my clumsy questions. So let me give you an example. The widow of the sometime OBL senator from Dorchester County is a distant relative of mine. Her name is Miss Pritchard Muckenbooth. And I said, Miss Pritchard, tell me something about the late Senator St. Clair Muckenbooth, your husband. And she said, well, in a word, he was lazy. So I said, now, Miss Pritchard, what do you mean? What do you mean by that? She says, well, let me put it this way. She said, he would come to work so late and leave to come home so early, he would meet himself on Main Street. And I said, now, Miss Pritchard, didn't you have a son, St. Clair Muckenbooth, that ran for office? She said, yes, but he didn't get very far. He was ahead of his time. I said, well, what do you mean, Miss Pritchard? She said, well, his slogan was rotate in 48. And I said, well, how is that ahead of his time? But he ran in 46. So she said, but he later became a very successful corporate attorney in New York City, worked with PepsiCo. I said, really? She said, yeah, but they couldn't get used to his name, St. Clair Muckenbooth. So he changed it to Marshall. I said, oh, well, that's very nice, St. Clair Marshall said. No, he changed it to Marshall Muckenbooth. So you see, I never got to the bottom of the political situation. Let me at this time recognize our guest of honor, Mrs. M.E. Bradford. Marie is, as you know, not properly speaking a guest, but a member of this society, was constantly with Mel at our meetings over the years. Mel and Marie would take the table at one of the meals, and all the other Southern members would gravitate toward that table, sort of a Confederate island in the cosmopolitan sea at the Drake Hotel, and an implicit rebuke against any contemplated exercise in free thinking. Mel always insisted that Marie travel with him, and not just for the companionship, although that's a sufficient reason, but also because she was his best and most engaged critic. Marie is an editor by profession, and Mel told me he would deliberately schedule long car trips so that they could argue out their latest editorial differences and come to some resolution. Mel depended on Marie to organize many of his simultaneous literary projects, and certainly we have Mel to thank quality of his writings, but we have very largely to thank for the sheer number of those writings as they were produced over the years. Marie's labors in that regard have not ended. Two of Mel's earlier works have been reissued posthumously, one with the help of very great help of Forrest and Ellen McDonald. And I'm also delighted to announce that Mel's principal uncollected essays will appear under the title, As I Was Saying, New Essays in the Old Tradition. ISI will publish the book in 1995, and Marie has very kindly agreed to cast her jeweler's eye on the manuscript. Marie, thank you so much for being here. Salvatore Prize for 1994's most distinguished contribution to the American Founding Studies in recognition of his magisterial new book on the American presidency. Speaking of new books, one of our most long-standing members, M. Stanton Evans, has produced what many early readers consider his very best book, The Theme of Freedom, is just out, available for Regnery. And as a matter of fact, Fred Mann is here with several copies at a discount if you want to seek him out at the meeting. And finally, we all owe the usual debt of gratitude to Don Lipson and Julie Glick for the months of preparation that it took to make this conference a reality. And let me also announce that they are already hard at work at the 1995 national meeting, which will be in April 28th and 30th at the Sheraton Society Hill in Philadelphia. But Don and Julie, thanks for everything. Over the course of just a few months, two of the first men American conservative revival had been taken from us. At the time of Henry Bradford's sudden death, the next regional meeting of the Philadelphia Society had already been planned as a celebration of Russell Kirk's life's work. Dr. Kirk's brief talk at that meeting 1 year ago in Dearborn, Michigan, proved to be a valediction. Now we are meant to consider the legacy of Dr. Kirk's great friend. And I should point out to our guests that it's really quite extraordinary for the society to be given over to the study of a single figure. And yet there was immediate consensus that these two back-to-back regional meetings of the Philadelphia Society should be held in honor of Russell Kirk and Henry Bradford. Such is the judgment of their peers, if indeed it may be said that Kirk and Bradford have peers. Now, given the juxtaposition of these events and the fact that both Kirk and Bradford are recent presidents of the Society, I thought it appropriate to very briefly comment on the friendship between these two giants. Long before their first meeting, Bradford had revered Kirk as an authority and as the first man of our movement. Although he was still in his 30s, Bradford at that time already had a bibliography as long as one of those arms of his. And Kirk had taken particular note of articles on Randolph of Roanoke, which appeared in Modern Age, or on articles on Donald Davidson, articles on Richard Weaver. I happened to have been present at each of their early meetings, watched their relationship grow from mutual respect to friendship and finally to abiding affection. The first time Bradford visited Kirk's home in Michigan, it was the dead of winter. I remember the year is 1974, but in any event, I'm sure that there was more than a foot of snow on the ground. And as we watched from the steps, the small car that had been sent to fetch Bradford from the airport slid to the hall to in the snow, and what seemed like a ridiculously small door opened, and to unfold the huge bulk of M.E. Bradford, topped by a broad-brimmed hat in gray and dressed in what looked to all the world like the cape of a Confederate cavalry officer. The contrast could not have been more stark to the dark suit and diminutive figure of the squire of Piety Hill, born a few miles from the Canadian border and descended from a race of New England Puritans. But as they arranged themselves before the hearth on that cold day, the warmth of their early rapport resumed in a moment. And in retrospect, that's not all that surprising. Of their contemporaries, only Bradford approached Kirk in the sheer breadth of erudition. Kirk, the great Tory interpreter of the old Whigs, and Bradford, an old Whig himself, a genuine artist. Here is what Bradford had to say to Russell Kirk in an article entitled A Proper Patrimony. We have had from Kirk's astonishing career proof of a profound interest in the acts and monuments of Europe. In truth, the demonstration of this concern is so considerable that hostile comment on the Wizard of Lancaster has sometimes argued from it that he is only a cultural expatriate, a connoisseur of archaic places, persons, and emotions. But because of the fashion in which Kirk links this passion to his perspective on the formation of our nation, and who is here talking to the roots of the American order, we can now insist that Russell Kirk was always occupied with the old world chiefly because of his identification with the new. In all of his explorations, Kirk writes as a recognizable variety of American. If that American speaks in the English idiom of an old Whig or moderate Tory, the inheritance he applies to our situation has all the more authority in its application of the mores majorum, formed and tested long ago by the intellectually most significant of our progenitors. A habit of mind built into the language it created and sanctioned. Where the study of these roots is concerned, we all begin with Russell Kirk. Here's what Kirk said of Bradford in a preface to the reissue of A Better Guide Than Raisin. Yet Mel Bradford and I found ourselves as one in political and literary principles. The two of us endeavored to uphold the permanent things against political and economic centralization, against the degradation of the democratic dogma, against literary nihilism, against educational standardization without standards, we ventured to set our faces. Still, Kirk continues here, Father Martin Darcy used to say that heaven is a state of being in which all good things of one's earthly existence are forever present to the soul, not in memory merely, but in their original fullness. God willing, then, the long-enduring friendship between Bradford and this writer may survive the tooth of Cronus, time the devourer. Well, let us believe that Kirk's prayer, written in one of the last sentences he composed, has been granted and the two old friends are together. And let us pray in turn that in God's good time, each of us will once again sit at their feet. Our speaker this noon is William Murchison, syndicated columnist, senior columnist at the Dallas Morning News, editor of the Texas Republic, and great friend to conservatism. He is published everywhere that you and I go to read the truth. And Bill Murchison doesn't write from an ivory tower, but writes and acts in solidarity with the working elements of the American conservative movement. As a columnist, Bill Murchison's aim has been described as putting passing events in perspective to show what they mean under the aspect of eternity. The echo is Mr. Andrew Leibler, I pray. His brand new book, which I have here, is Reclaiming Morality in America. It's published by Thomas Nelson of Nashville, and it has been praised by everybody from Cal Thomas to John Cotton, Cardinal O'Connor. Now, Bill Murchison, as you know, is very close to Mel Bradford's political and philosophical positions, but he is also as decidedly high church as Mel was low church. in the same spirit that Jeffrey Hart calls Mill the Confederate boatman, let us welcome Bill Murchison as the Episcopalian Bradford.